London Calling. London Walks here with the Friday special. Yes, Friday's the day we double down, put out two podcasts, the daily Today in London History podcast, and a special, a wild card. The last few weeks, the Friday special has been a series of talks by art historian Helena Jones about the two undeniable masterpieces in the Wallace Collection. And Helena will be back, you'll be glad to hear, in a couple of weeks. It looks like her art history, art appreciation podcasts are going to get into a regular routine of one a month. She thinks the next one will be coming out in a fortnight. So that means the other three, sometimes four, Friday specials will be the usual London Walks potpourri. Interviews with guides, interviews with Londoners, excerpts from walks, breaking stories, reviews, historical vignettes, whatever strikes my London roving eye, really. I had thought for this first Friday special, since Helena wound up her most recent short series of talks, I had thought to do a piece about Bart's Hospital, not least because there's a fine connection there with a subject that was touched on in a recent Today in London History podcast. But I've decided to postpone that. The course adjustment brought about, as is so often the case, by a last-minute chance encounter. On my old Westminster walk yesterday afternoon was a lovely Ukrainian lady. She's lived here for 30 years, and in the way of these things, at walk's end, the two of us, both immigrants, both deeply in love with our adopted city, got into a chat, compared notes, talked about London and Londoners and, yes, the English, and the unique cultural brew of this city, the feel of the place, what it's like to live here. Anyway, our chat summoned up from the well of memory a passage from one of the greatest books ever written about London, V.S. Pritchett's London Perceived. The book is now 60 years old. London has changed tremendously, of course, in those intervening years. But London Perceived has stood up. In it, Pritchett's done what I wouldn't have thought was possible. He's captured, in words on the page, what I thought could only be sensed, felt, guessed at. Namely, the protean, evanescent, indefinable essence of London. Notes that high, it's music of the spheres. It shouldn't be possible to actually hear the music of the spheres. Set it out in prose. It's a kind of miracle, really. An accomplishment beyond estimable. And remembering one passage in particular, memories make us rich. I decided on a course correction for this podcast. I decided to put us down on a different airstrip altogether. Decided to introduce you to Pritchett's book. Do a short reading from it. For anyone who doesn't know him, V.S. Pritchett was a 20th century master of the art of English prose. He was a brilliant novelist, short story writer, literary critic, travel writer, and essayist. London Perceived is really a book-length essay about this wondrous city. And 20th century is really an appropriate adjectival phrase to put in front of V.S. Pritchett's name. Because he was born in 1900, Queen Victoria was still on the throne, and he died in 1997, when Victoria's great-great-granddaughter, Queen Elizabeth II, was just a few years away from the golden jubilee of her reign. Okay, here's the passage. It comes very near the beginning of the book. It opens with Pritchett quoting another great writer, the American novelist Henry James. It's Henry James's first impressions of London. Those, Henry James's impressions, are Pritchett's springboard for his, Pritchett's observations about foreigners and London, what they make of London, and indeed about Londoners, and how they see us, foreigners who've thrown in our lot with them, made their city our city, and in time become, like the Ukrainian lady, like me, American-born but London-marinated, in time become Londoners. In the last analysis, though, the passage is a paean to London, a love letter to this unique, magical city, a love letter written with the lightest of touches. Here's the passage. I turned to Henry James's notebooks, the entry made in 1881 when he recorded his decision to give up Boston, his disillusion with Paris, and the judgment that London was the best place for him. He sat before his coal fire with the draft blowing down his back at Morley's Hotel, since pulled down, near Trafalgar Square, after a tortuous and rather horrible journey in a cab from the Black Greek Arch at Euston. They have just pulled it down. He has described his emotions in English Hours, and the chapters on London in that book evoke a city that, despite a fault here and there and the passage of time, is permanent. The notebooks, being a diary, put the matter in brief. It is difficult to speak adequately or justly of London. It is not a pleasant place. It is not agreeable, or cheerful, or easy, or exempt from reproach. It is only magnificent. You can draw up a tremendous list of reasons why it should be insupportable. The fogs, the smoke, the dirt, the darkness, the wet, the distances, the ugliness, the brutal size of the place, the horrible numerosity of society, the manner in which this senseless bigness is fatal to amenity, to convenience, to conversation, to good manners. All this and much more you may expatiate upon. You may call it dreary, heavy, stupid, dull, inhuman, vulgar at heart and tiresome in form. But for one who takes it as I take it, London is, on the whole, the most possible form of life. Now Pritchett continues, the extraordinary thing is that despite the blunder of the splodge as a whole, life is wonderfully livable in this city. So much has been left to nature and human nature and their privacies. After the first chills of loneliness, after their unbelief before the climate, after their astonished failure to find a congenial nightlife, foreigners usually astonish us by coming to the same conclusion. They may not like us, but they like the place. Since 1940, they have liked it enormously. London has its immigrants who come for the money. The West Indians, the Africans, the Indians, the Pakistani, the Italians, the Cypriots, the Irish pour in. But more flattering than these is the large and growing population of expatriates, people getting out of the new, expanding, aggressive countries with a future, a program, and a zeal for the human race. Americans, South Africans, Australians, Canadians slip out of their societies and are added to the Jews of the 30s, the Hungarians, Poles, Czechs, and so on, who wish to be left to live outside the reach of ideologues and witch hunters, and as they please. London loves the morbidities of freedom. It has been the traditional refuge from despotism and persecution from the 17th century onwards. Although Londoners are, more than any other city people, wary of foreigners, although London landladies are Britannias armed with helmet, shield, trident, and have faces with the word "no" stamped like a coat of arms on them, the place is sentimental and tolerant. The attitude to foreigners is like the attitude to dogs. Dogs are neither human nor British, but so long as you keep them under control, give them their exercise, feed them, pat them, you will find their wild emotions are amusing and their characters interesting. They even have their own sometimes enviable life. They assume your habits and, such are the pleasures of British loneliness, they become a man's best friend. The Bayswater landlady gazes at her spaniel and says, with proud complacency, he's trying to say something. So is the foreigner. After a year or two of resentment, the foreigner recognizes that London is a place where we are all mongrels together, mainly on leash, but let out for short, mad, daily scampers in the park. But perhaps the quality that does most to make London livable is its respectability. This is often mocked, and there have been periods when respectability has been pushed to extremes. But after a lifetime of travel in Europe, Asia, and America, I am convinced that to be respectable is one of the pinnacles of universal human desire, felt as strongly in the heart of the Persian nomad as it is in New York, Chicago, Valparaiso, or Tooting Beck, and that London has very often known the art of concocting this subtle elixir. A subtle elixir. Come to think of it, that's a pretty good description of a great walking tour. You've been listening to the Friday special London Walks podcast, emanating from www.walks.com, home of London's multi-award-winning walking tour company. Indeed, London's only award-winning walking tour company. As they so kindly put it a few years ago at that American Convention of Walking Tour Guides, London Walks is the premier walking tour company in the entire world. The secret? It's pretty obvious, really. The muzzle-loading velocity of the guiding. In the words of that American filmmaker, if this were a golf tournament, every name on the leaderboard would be a London Walks guide. At no little risk of belaboring the obvious, with London Walks, uniquely, you get walking tours fronted by accomplished professionals. Barristers, doctors, historians, the former editor of Independent Television News, Royal Shakespeare Company actors, Museum of London archaeologists, the world's leading expert on Jack the Ripper, distinguished academics, a Cambridge University paleontologist, a University College London geologist, elite, award-winning, professionally qualified Blue Badge guides, etc. Guides who make the new familiar, and the familiar new. And on that note, see you every day with the Today in London History podcast, and see you next Friday with the Friday special. Good Londoning, one and all, and glad you're back. You were sorely missed.